Coming up on the Shelley Irwin Show podcast today, we talk about the book The Navigator's Letter, a true story of World War II. The National Park Grandma talks about her new book, Mouse Visits Everglades National Park. We continue to spotlight the initiative of GR250 with Don Cooper, COO of the Gerald R. Ford Foundation. We talk about the book The Hospital at the End of the World and the importance of taking your toddler to the dentist.
Let's talk about a piece of time in history, The Navigator's Letter, the true story of two World War II airmen, a doomed mission, and the woman who bound them together. I look forward to this conversation, Jan Kress-Dondi, about your new book. Good morning, Jan.
Hey, how are you? Thank you for having me on the show.
Quite well. Thank you for you and the good work you do and will continue to do. It looks like you're in your world has surrounded this for a bit, born in Illinois, where the inspiration for The Navigator's Letter took root. Tell me about the letter and this inspiration.
So I guess the kickstart for this story came when I found a footlocker filled with probably 500 or 600 letters written from my uncle and my father during wartime back to family members back home. And it sort of took me down. I started reading them and realized that there was a big story here. I've never written a book before, but it was something that I felt was relevant and needed to be told, needed to be shared. The story takes you on the surface. It's a story about the U.S. campaign to destroy the Nazi fuel supply, Hitler's fuel supply at Ploiești, Romania, through the eyes of these two men, John B. and Bob, and they happen to be my father and my uncle. But it's more than just a history, a military history. It's a deeply human story told through their eyes and their voices. The majority of the book, it has their firsthand voices melded into the National Archive, documents from the National Archives. I went through about 100,000 documents, American and German, to make sure I got the authenticity that this story deserved and put together a story that I believe carries the entire campaign from Operation Tidal Wave, which was the first ever low-level raid. They actually called it a zero-altitude raid. It's where the bombers were flying at a height of 50 feet to 150 feet above the ground. So you can imagine above your house, 50 feet, these huge bombers, 150, flew into Romania, Ploiești, Romania. And as they went into on the mission, they were low level to avoid radio, to avoid radar. So, and there was also radio silence, so they couldn't talk between planes. Mm. And it was five groups of five groups of airmen. Three groups from the 8th Air Force in England came down to North Africa with the 9th Air Force, and five groups. Each group was about 36 planes. Five groups took off from Benghazi and headed north toward Romania. It was a 12 or 14 hour round trip flight. The last three groups got lost, not lost, but they held back. From the first two groups. The first group made a wrong turn. The second group followed them. My uncle was in the second group. They realized that there was a wrong turn, so they made a left turn or north to Ploiești and ended up going into the heaviest defenses in Europe. Hitler knew that his oil fields were going to one day be attacked, so he fortified them second only to Berlin. And they went in, and it was a turkey shoot. I mean, they were 50 feet above. The guys in the airplanes could see the faces of the guys on the ground shooting back at them. And as a result, a third of the planes were lost, and 532 men went missing in action, including my uncle.
Yes. Let me break in. The Navigator's Letter is your work. Again, Jan Kress-Dondi with the book. I trust this was one of the bloodiest and most heroic missions of all time?
Yes. Yes. I mean, it definitely goes down in the annals of history as one of the bloodiest ever.
Tell me, what is the wartime connection between your father, Bob Kress, and Uncle John B. White? Were there connections before and after the war as well, you might have mentioned?
Yes. They've known each other since my father befriended his family back in the fifth grade when he was a little kid. My father was the son of a dairy farmer, so he lived just out of town, and his mother wanted him to go to school in town because he felt the education was better in town. And so it was that time that he befriended John B.'s younger brother. And so Bob was a frequent visitor in John B.'s home, and Bob always looked up to John B. John B. was a few years older, but they grew up knowing each other. You know, the town they grew up in was only 4,000 people, so they had a tight bond and a connection. John B. ended up going to University of Illinois. He graduated and went on to law school. Bob was in when John B. was called to service. And then Bob was in University of Illinois, headed to law school when he was called to serve. So both of them independently joined the Army Air Corps. Both of them independently were assigned as B-24 navigators, and both flew their bomb groups into combat. And both of them, both of them went into Ploesti, were shot in action over Ploesti. My father was on a high-level altitude mission that came later after the original low-level mission. So the connection is both of them were shot down over the same target. One was in the 8th Air Force out of England. The other was out of the 15th Air Force in Italy. But they were both shot down and went missing in action over the same Vega Concordia oil refinery in Ploesti.
Yes. What the tagline, the true story of two World War II airmen, a doomed mission, and the woman who bound them together. Talk about the woman.
So the woman is actually my mother, and she's the one that saved all the letters. And she was the connection between the two. John B., Bob's best friend, Bill, was John B.'s little brother. Bill's twin sister was Polly. So Bob had known Polly since fifth grade and had, again, grown up with them. But Bob was more like a brother figure growing up with Polly because he was always at the house. She was more interested in, I'll say, shinier guys, not a dairy farmer. And while she was kind and fun-loving, she was a devil-may-care kind of person. And so Bob was sort of the boy that rescued her when she couldn't call her brother to rescue her. So they were good friends all along, and she was the one that experienced both of them going missing in action.
How was life in Alaska living for you off the cuff?
Oh, I absolutely loved it, and I'd probably still be there. I lived for 6 years in Alaska. I lived basically in Anchorage, and I worked for a law firm up there. I went up on a one-way ticket on a whim. My brother lives up there, and I went up to visit him, and I just decided to stay and ended up becoming a paralegal there. I also went back part-time to get a teaching certificate. I already had a degree in marketing and merchandising, but I wanted to teach in the bush. So I got I part-time went to school from University of Alaska. I got a teaching certificate so I could go out in the bush. I did go out and student teach and substitute teach, but I decided bush living really wasn't for me. And although I lived without water and electricity for a year, which was in my 20s, my adventure years, and I loved it. I absolutely loved it. But what brought me back to Florida was a college sweetheart.
Yep.
I was sent to Texas to do some discovery work, and he was in Texas at the time, and we reconnected. So that's why I left Alaska. I love Alaska. It's fabulous.
Wonderful.
Anybody should go there.
Wonderful. Well, yes, your talents, of course, are writing the Navigator's Letter, but it's always nice to know about you. And you, just with a couple minutes left, you You have presented this, you've spoken about your father's POW experience at the U.S. Embassy in Bucharest?
I did. I spoke. When I started this, I did go to Romania, and I met with an aeronautical aviation expert who took me to the site where his plane was shot down. He also gave me the name of the pilot that claimed his plane. So, of course, I had to go get his records. And as it turns out, interesting enough, early on, when John B. was over the Bay of Biscay doing his sub-patrol, anti-sub-patrol, this guy, the German pilot, was doing patrol there at the same time. And then he's also the one that claimed credit for downing my father's plane. So I had to go to, I couldn't get the records online. So on a trip to Europe, I said to my husband, why don't we just go to Fribourg and just see if they'll let me get in? And with a lot of cajoling and telling, if not for the humanity of a German fighter and a pilot, I might not be here. And there's a story behind that, but I don't know that you have enough time for that.
No, and we just do cliff notes, as they say, in a roundabout way, so that we tease one to grab the navigator's letter. All right, Jan, how do we find out more information about your work?
So the book is on. It's available now for order, so please pre-order today. It helps the book succeed. And if we need to get these kind of stories out, because these guys are passing away every day, and to learn about World War II and to preserve their stories, it helps to not romanticize war. War is an ugly thing, and you can find the book online at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, The Navigator's Letter, or you can look on my website, jancrestdondi.com, and you can learn more about the book. But I encourage you to take a look at it, and please pre-order and order it. It's available now. Get copies, and I appreciate the time on your show.
It's The Navigator's Letter, the true story of two World War II airmen, a doomed mission, and the woman who bound them together, part of your family. Appreciate you, Jan Crest Dondi. Take care. She's okay with the name. She's National Park Grandma, an award-winning children's author, rancher, great-grandmother, dedicated to helping kids fall in love with America's national parks. Maybe the big kids will fall in love as well, too. Trisha Gardella on the line, creator of the 10-book Mouse Traveler series. Yep, plays full storytelling, fun facts, and more. Nothing like a cool mouse. Your latest is out. Good morning to you, Trisha.
Good morning.
How did you get the name National Park Grandma?
People started calling me that because I became so obsessed. I never intended to write a series, and I fell in love with Mouse when we did a book called Absurd Said Bird, and it grew from there.
Wonderful. America's national parks, how important are these to keep alive, not only in our kids that are young at heart, but in our growing up kids, Trisha?
I think they're just important to the world because we need to keep some things the way they were originally, and it's a good place for that and for helping animals that are endangered and for just studying the world and the earth. And I live close to Yosemite, so it has always been important to me. It's just beautiful.
But there's a mountain in your backyard. Your writing, Trisha, has appeared in Highlights Magazine, a favorite of many. You've been featured, of course, on regional TV, print, lifetime member of the Society of Children's Book Writers, Children's Book Writers and Illustrators. So here we are. So let's talk about your series, Mouse Traveler, and just releasing your 10th book, Mouse Visits Everglades National Park.
Yeah, we're just working right now on our 12th book. But, you know, they just keep, we could just get enthused about them. Excuse me.
Yes, as you should, because they're, you know, we're so blessed with parks, but keep going. Yes.
Well, there are, that I know of, at least 63 now, and there is no way that I'm going to be able to write about each one of them, but we're doing some multiple places that he's learned how to move from park to park now too. He couldn't do that at the beginning. So things have just keep developing. And what I find the most fun about this is that I feel in a lot of ways it's Mouse who's writing the story, and I'm the one going along for the ride.
Let's put the spotlight on Mouse Visits Everglades National Park. We forget that Everglades National Park is up for our visit. What's special about this?
Well, for one thing that I think is really exciting is it's the only place in the world where crocodiles and alligators live door to door. That's exciting. The other thing is they have animals like manatees and some of the water birds, especially. It's one of the biggest breeding grounds. And Everglades is just very different from any other national park. And I'm glad that they've preserved it.
Yes, and Mouse, again, exploring Everglades National Park. A common theme that runs through, looks like, your visits to the national parks, Tricia. I mean, educational content. Each, what, introduces kids to the geography and wildlife of America?
It does, but specifically to that area. I think that that's important to know that different animals live in different areas. I really try, to me, the most important thing is that children need to have books that they can learn from, but first the book has to be fun and something that they want to act with. So I try to write my things in a fun way, but with a lot of information buried. And then in the I have back matter that goes into it deeper and has questions that parents or teachers can ask. And I also have on my park books especially, but some of my other books too, I have lesson plans because I think that they're important. I just really think that these belong in classrooms.
Yes, for sure. What about the colorful illustrations? Tell me about how this engages young readers.
For me, it's magic. To me, an illustrator is more than half your book. I don't tell my illustrators what I envision. What I want to do is see what they, if they see what I'm painting with words, and I've been very lucky so far. And when Ginger Nielsen, who is the illustrator for the Mouse Traveler series, did the first Mouse, I just fell for it. And I love what she does, and we just get along really well.
That's important with an end game work. Tricia Gardella with us. She's known as National Park Grandma, award-winning children's author, and, of course, dedicated to helping kids fall in love with America's national parks in the Mouse Traveler series. So, yes, you've taken us to Arcadia, Carlsbad Caverns, Grand Canyon, and more, and a couple more are going to be out after Everglades National Park. Tricia?
Well, yes, and one of the ones that I'm really excited about, and I don't know where it came from me, but this year, some of my other Christmas books were moving pretty well. And I thought, you know, we need something like that for Mouse. And he's doing the 12 days of Christmas, but he's going to 12 national parks. And it's really been fun working on that.
Nice. Well, we know mice can be critters sometimes, but what is it about the mouse that we actually love? And I'm speaking from personal love of mice.
Yeah, well, I don't love them either, especially when they get in your cupboards. But yeah. I love this mouse, and he's just got a special something about him, but he's really cute too. And he meets other mice. That was one of his main goals, is to see what other mice. So every book we go into, what other mice are also found in that park, or we try to. And it's really hard for me to say what it is, but he's just a very cute character. That's... And I'm having a lot of fun with him because I'm also a crafter. I've always been a crafter, and I'm making things to go with the books that I will have on my Shopify store.
Nice. Last question. Why is it important that we visit or learn about these America's national parks, Tricia Gardella?
Well, what has scared me is just recent things that have been going on. Some of the parks have oil or, you know, different things that we need to keep us going. But some of me, you know, I don't want to see them able to go in and take whatever they want from it. And it's been a big fight from the beginning because there are people that believed in national parks and there are people that think it's more important that we get whatever we can out of the national parks. So it isn't something new where there's this controversy. And what I find really fun is that sort of the way that national parks started was because of what we did to the Niagara Falls. And when Europeans were really criticizing what we did. And that's sort of how national parks got started, because people didn't want to lose everything. So now we do a lot of national parks, but there's so many unique places in this country that need to be preserved. And it's just right that our future generations be able to see them other than in a book, if they want to.
Yep. How do we find out more information about your work?
Well, I have a website, TrishaGardella.com. It's pretty easy. Or I also have a store, ShopTrishaGardella.com. So, and you'll find that on my website, too.
Wonderful. National Park Grandma, you are Trisha Gardella. Please take care.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you.
All right, do the math. 136 days, 13 hours, 30 minutes, and Don Cooper, we're down to 38, 37, 36 seconds until...
until the 250th anniversary of our nation's founding, Shelley. It's a big year for us.
Big year for us and a big year for Grand Rapids as we are involved. Let me do a nice formal introduction to you. Glad that your doors are back open. Gerald R. Ford Foundation, Don Cooper, UCOO, and of course doing great things in our own backyard. And yes, very instrumental in this GRA 250. We're doing a regular commentary on what's happening and why it should be happening. What is this initiative, Don?
Shelley, first, thanks. It's great to be here. I've been in here so many times, and it's the first time behind the microphone, so it is an honor to be here talking about GRA 250. And what GRA 250 is a citywide initiative to celebrate our nation's founding and to recommit ourselves to the founding principles of our nation and think about what it means to be a Grand Rapidian today and going into the future. So our nation was founded on citizens. It was founded on civic engagement. It was founded on all of us being able to come together around a common purpose, solve problems together, advance together. We recognize that there are flaws. We're not perfect, but we can get better over time. So GRA 250 is the citywide initiative to mobilize around those principles, get more people active, engaged, realize the great things that have occurred in Grand Rapids in our nation, and the progress that we need to make together to more fully live the promise that our founders made 250 years ago.
Nice. And of course, with 175 years of Grand Rapids, what an opportunity to partnership up here. And I know lots has been happening behind the scenes. You're now reaching out with your wonderful doers in the community to do such and to bring this initiative to fruition. We're not talking everybody needs a July 4th parade, right, Don?
No, not everybody needs a July 4th parade, even though those are a lot of fun and fireworks are great to bring people around and just great activities. But what we're really talking about is new ways to engage and mobilize citizens in Grand Rapids throughout the community in different places. So this just isn't a downtown initiative. This is a neighborhood initiative. Our goal is to equip and empower people throughout the city in different ways to engage with our founding principles and, more importantly, to engage with each other as citizens and neighbors about how we can come together and solve common problems, work together with a purpose, make progress together, and build a better Grand Rapids to sustain us for the next 250 years.
You have that nailed down. And, of course, Gerald R. Ford Foundation, only one of the many instrumental behind-the-scenes worker bees you and your team are for this. I want to get right into the Democracy Cafe. What's this?
So Democracy Cafe is one of our signature initiatives. And one thing we're really proud about with Democracy Cafe is that it's not just Grand Rapids. It's connected to the state's initiative, too. So Democracy Cafe is something that has been funded and supported by the state's America 250 Committee, and it's become one of our signature initiatives in the city. It is a mobile civic engagement experience designed to spark conversation, reflection, and conversation with people who participate in it. So, Shelley, think of it kind of like a pop-up cafe, like a pop-up coffee shop that's part exhibit, part conversation starter, part community forum. It's a place that we're trying to create where people can just kind of let down their guard and talk to their fellow citizens over a free cup of coffee, a free cookie, and think about issues that affect them and our community around voting, around democratic engagement, around volunteerism, around participation. So often right now when we engage with each other, the temperatures are real high. It's a lot of the flashpoints. And we lose sight of the things that bring us together and the common principles that we have. So Democracy Cafe is an effort to go out in the communities. It'll be out where people are at, to just have a forum where people can come together around those common principles and have those civil conversations around the things that bring us together and that's going to move our city forward.
On your GRA250.com website is the drop-down to Democracy Cafe, and you actually ask us to fill out a form because this is how I get one of the experiences at one of my events.
Yeah, let us know where you want it. Democracy Cafe, it's a mobile experience. It's designed to travel around the city. You're going to see it in certain places throughout the city. The next place Democracy Cafe is going to be set up is at the Grand Rapids Policy Conference at the Grand Rapids that's hosted by the Grand Rapids Chamber on March 6th. And that's a really special conference because the Democracy Defense Project is bringing together a bipartisan group of leaders, a couple of former governors, a couple of other former leaders of both parties, to talk about why democracy is important in civic engagement. So Democracy Cafe is honored to be a part of that. You'll see it over at the Gerald Ford Museum at different points in time. You'll see it throughout the city. And if any of the listeners here, if there are community groups, if there are events, locations throughout the city that thinks this would be a really great place for Democracy Cafe to be, visit our website and let us know. We'll work with you to set it up.
I know subcommittees hard at work from athletics to, of course, events, healthcare, military, museum, and arts. Of course, you're strongly coordinated philanthropy, sister mm-hmm. cities, youth, and more. Other activities that are starting to sprout up, would you say?
Oh, my goodness, Shelley. The next 130-some days are going to be real active for us. So over that time, already this year, we've had a GRA 250 games, if you will, between Grand Valley State University and Davenport, men's and women's basketball, a cross-city game. You know, two teams, but really one city that brings us together around some common principles. Other big things that we're working on are some youth-facing initiatives. So we're putting together a civics camp for kids over at the Gerald Ford Museum. We're working on putting together a time capsule, so more on that to come. Democracy Cafe will, of course, be in different places, but this is really going to be a year where you see an elevation of the civic experiences, so naturalization ceremonies to welcome our new Americans into our community, big speakers and events coming into town that promote civics, American principles, our founding, and what we can do together to make progress to becoming a more perfect union as our founders envisioned. So pay attention to our website. Our next 136 days are going to be really active. And Shelley, we also hope the momentum doesn't end at that and that it sparks a new sense of civic engagement throughout Grand Rapids and we continue to be engaged.
Yes. Again, on the website, there's a GRA 250 night at Berlin Raceway this summer. I know the time capsule ceremony, as you mentioned, is pretty cool. Neighbor woods will be sprouting and planting for a future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And one of my favorite GRA 250 events is once a quarter or so, we're hosting a trivia night around different periods of American history. So we've had one on the founding, we've had one on the early 19th century, and it gets real competitive with the teams there.
There we go. That's a good competition. Good for the brain. All right, Don Cooper. Well, again, it doesn't end on July 4th. It only is highlighted perhaps on that particular day, peaked maybe for lack of better terms, as that's the official birthday, but many celebrate birthdays all year long.
Absolutely. And And we've got another 250 years to go after this too, Shelley. So let's make it a great one.
Thank you for your leadership and the team. Of course, the great work of the Gerald R. Ford Foundation. Don Cooper, one more time, that website is?
GRA250.com. Check it out and see what's going on.
May you ask for your democracy cafe. We should have one down the lobby of WGVU. There we go. I'm going to fill out the paperwork.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Don.
Great. Thanks, Shelley.
This will keep you on the edge of your seat. Let's talk to my next guest. Excellent early reviews are coming in for Justin C. Key's debut novel, The Hospital at the End of the World. It's a gripping near-future medical thriller about a young doctor in training who uncovers the truth behind his father's death in a world run by AI. Lots of topics to discuss. We first of all say hello to you, Justin Key. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Thanks for having me here.
You are quite well. I trust you are in the healthcare world professionally?
Yes. Yes. I'm a practicing psychiatrist. And actually, you know, I see a full panel of patients, maybe about like 40 to 50 a week in an outpatient setting.
Thank you. Just a bit more about you, because I'm interested. Why did you choose the niche of psychiatry?
Oh, okay. Yeah, good question. So going into medical school, I actually didn't really know much about psychiatry. I went in thinking maybe I wanted to be a surgeon. I had been fascinated with neuroscience and the brain. So I knew a little bit about neurology, and I remember I shadowed pediatrics. That was expecting a kid my first year of med school. Orthopedic surgery and neurology. But I had been writing for a while going into it. And if you ask my medical school classmates, they'd think that I was gung-ho for psychiatry from the beginning. But it found me in my first year. I remember actually going to an autism conference there and talking to a child psychiatrist there. And his MO actually, I didn't know it at the time, was to recruit child psychiatrists. So I did research in autism and then I also found that other writer physicians were psychiatrists. There was a panel for writer physicians, and two out of three of them were psychiatrists. And the next year, a separate two out of three were also psychiatrists. So it really aligned with my just want to define stories. So as a writer, I define stories on the page. And as a psychiatrist, and I also do a lot of therapy, like learning about people's stories and also helping them discover their own story. It really just, you know, it aligned well. And also psychiatry just is more aware of wellness and that work-life balance and, you know, more protective of burnout. So it also aligned well with me entering medical school and starting a family and being married and knowing that I didn't want to have some of the lifestyle, for example, of a neurosurgeon.
Wow. Thank you for, again, getting personal. Yet it serves as a background to your novel, The Hospital at the End of the World. What's your storyline? What is this about, Justin?
Oh, yeah. So The Hospital at the End of the World, if you imagine about 20 years in the future, a step in the future, you know, we've given over the reins of society over to AI. And this national conglomerate, the Shepherd Organization, has bought all of the top medical schools in the country. So the novel follows this young medical student, Pac, as he flees like an AI-driven New York City to actually go learn old-fashioned medicine in New Orleans. And New Orleans is actually the last holdout city in the United States that's refused to adopt AI. So Pac, as a medical student, he needs to navigate the difficulties of medical school, which is very much rooted in my own experience in medical school, and also unraveling family secrets to uncover the truth of his father's mysterious death. You know, so the book is about, at its core, it's AI versus medicine, but it's really, I really wanted to bring out the importance of the human connection, not just in the physician-patient interaction, but just, you know, in overall human interaction, because there's so many implications with AI, as we're seeing now with art, law, and sports, romance. And I really wanted to touch on a lot of that in this book.
Obviously, I trust you got a few of your ideas for stories and characters, perhaps from your own patients, not breaking the rules of HIPAA, but changing the names where needed.
Yes. So, interestingly, I've been very aware of that from the beginning, and I've always wanted to avoid doing that directly. One of my influences is Michael Crichton. And, you know, he wrote Jurassic Park and others. But he went to Harvard Medical School. And he actually had published books by the time he was in Harvard Medical School. And his one story that his professors were talking about the scientific validity of one of his novels when he was in a room, not knowing that he had written it. But in his memoir, Travels, he talks about stepping away from medicine early on because he found himself thinking in when with a patient, oh, they would make a great character, and he wouldn't want his doctor thinking that. So I read that before I went to medical school. So I've been, I was almost anxious about it going through. So I've actually been able to really separate my mind, like when I'm in those moments, when I'm with a patient, when I'm going through these experiences, my writer brain really isn't working, not consciously. But then when I sit down later to write a story and I might find like, oh, for example, this patient is, or this character is experiencing psychosis, then I'm able to tap into my experiences. And one of the great things I think about, you know, having this background is I know what I don't know, you know, and I know that the perspective I have, for example, of psychosis or schizophrenia, you know, it's just one perspective, like what it might manifest for the character on the page. And also having that awareness that I don't want anybody to any reader to come away thinking, oh, this is what it looks like in everybody. So it definitely informs my writing. And as I go through, like the what ifs, you know, in terms of how technology is going to affect my field, that definitely comes through. But I try to keep it very separate so I'm not sitting with a patient thinking, oh, I can't wait to get home to write.
That's nice. Talk about your choice to write about AI, this AI system that can't handle certain human processes and tasks. For example, taking care of, what is it, POX locks?
Yes, POX locks, yes. So with that, I had an interest in AI very early on. So it was AI in the context of medicine. When I started the idea for this book, which is back in like 2013, and you know, AI back then was still very much speculative in our minds, like what is it going to become? And I had a lot of hope, you know, for what it might manifest, you know, thinking of a system that could take all of these data points and all of these studies and all of these other patient-physician interactions and just have that and put it in its analytic power and pop out some like really important insights that I think as a tool could really help physicians, but also being wary of like, there are some inherent things about being human that I don't really think we'd be able to replicate with AI. And I also wanting us to be aware and, you know, hesitant of that. And I think it's really manifesting now just in terms of, you know, the large language models being very good at, imitating humans, and so good that we may not be aware of like some of the nuances that they lack. So in the book, one of the things that I use as an example is hair. You know, growing up, I saw like hair was very important in my community, and it could be, you know, not just how it's styled, but being able to do hair for family members. You know, it could be a bonding experience. So I imagine that AI could, you know, be able to tell you this, what I'm telling you now, be able to, you know, for lack of a better term, grok the meaning of it. But I still think it would be lost in the actual nuance, like the things that we pick up as humans, like just being in the room with each other or seeing like a facial expression or seeing like just a shift in body positioning can mean so much to us as social creatures. So I really wanted to give like examples that I think people could resonate with and see clearly on the page. And like, okay, this is a very smart system, but it can't do some basic things that we're really, really great at doing as humans.
Yes. Well, I know you raise timely questions about autonomy, bias, human ties. No algorithm can replace, as you mentioned, drawing on your own background. The hospital at the end of the world. Tell me how we find out more information, Justin.
Yes. So you can go to justincky.com. So there's no S on the end of my name. Some people ask, it's just K-E-Y, like a house key. I'm also on social. It's, you know, Instagram, Justin C. Key. And also you can get The Hospital at the End of the World wherever you want to get books. You know, there's the major retailers, and also bookshop.org is a great place to support independent booksellers. But if you want to learn more about me and some of my past work as well, justincky.com.
Dr. Key, thank you for your work both in the author world and the medical world. You take care.
Thank you so much. This is great.
How many times do you brush your teeth? My next guest here to answer that question, especially when it comes to the kids, Dr. Tom Eisen with us. You are a big deal, presiding over a very important organization. Dr. Eisen, good morning to you.
Good morning, Shelley. Thanks for having me on.
Tell me about your day job and your national job.
Well, my day job is I'm a pediatric dentist in Evansville, Indiana. I take care of children all day long. As I say, I like to go to work and play. And then my other job is president of the American Academy of Pediatric Dentistry. Fortunate to be in a role of such a prestigious organization.
Thank you for that. How do we stand in the state of kids' teeth and taking care of them to make sure they grow into good adult teeth?
Well, you know, Shelley, one of the big issues right now is that dental caries is actually the most common childhood disease. It's more common, more prevalent than asthma. And so what we want to do is we want to get children into the dental office very early. The American Academy of Pediatric Dentistry recommends that children see their pediatric dentist by their first birthday. We know that if we get children into the office early, we can develop good oral habits, take care of the mouth, and set them up for a lifetime with a healthy mouth.
What would be considered good oral habits?
So good oral habits begins with keeping the teeth clean. We want to brush the teeth twice a day for 2 minutes, once in the morning and once at bedtime. And when I say we, that means I want the parents doing that. Children will want to play and brush their teeth, but they're not going to do the job of keeping the teeth clean. We need the parents to step in and to do that. And by keeping the teeth clean, we disrupt that food and that plaque. We get those sugars, that acid off the teeth, and that makes the teeth stronger and less likely to have cavities.
What should a parent or obviously a caregiver not be giving our young kids to eat or drink to perhaps negate proper teeth?
Sure. So, you know, parents, children all the time are wanting snacks. And when it comes to snacks, we know that the more often they have snacks, the more likely they are to have cavities. So if we're having snacks, we want to have them for a short time period, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, and take it away. We don't want to leave things out that they can graze upon. And then we want to choose healthy snacks. We want things like whole fruit or cheese. And we want to avoid the really sticky, sugary kind of foods, such as juice or fruit roll-ups.
When, Dr. Eisen, can a cavity begin to form in our little ones?
Well, a cavity can begin forming as soon as a tooth comes in. So that food and that plaque, if it's sitting on the tooth, it will turn those sugars into acid, and that will start to eat away the tooth or to dissolve the tooth away. And so we want to start brushing and taking care of them as soon as teeth come into the mouth.
And obviously, in these days, bracing can be part of keeping our teeth straight as we grow older?
Oh, absolutely. And the earlier that a child is into the dental office, the earlier that problems can be detected. Some problems may need some very early intervention in life, and some of them can wait until a child has all of their teeth in, you know, at 10 or 11, 12 years of age. And then it can even be corrected, into adulthood, but that's for the adult dentist, and I don't do that.
Dr. Tom Eisen, again, president of the American Academy of Pediatric Dentistry, important job you have, and a fellow Hoosier as well. What else is important to know when it comes to kids and teeth?
Well, you know, we've talked about a lot of things, but if you need more information, I would refer you to the American Academy of Pediatric Dentistry website, mychildrensteeth.org. mychildrensteeth.org. That'll have more information about the topics that we touched. But we want to get into the dental office early, we want to brush the teeth twice a day, and we want to choose healthy snacks.
They say it's as easy as that, but should we be flossing as well?
Flossing, absolutely. Flossing gets into the areas in between the teeth, and that's where the toothbrush can't get. So, yes, we want to floss. I don't care whether you're brushing or whether you're flossing before you brush or after you brush, as long as you're flossing.
And I trust our early intervention, prevention is the key to healthy adult teeth in most cases?
It absolutely is. The biggest indicator for cavities in adulthood is having cavities in childhood. So we know if we get in early, we can prevent cavities. Early visits and use of fluoride long term, we know that we can reduce lifetime dental costs by up to 50%.
All right. One more time, that best website, please.
Is mychildrensteeth.org.
Thank you to you for your leadership and continued success to you and the organization. Take care.
Thank you, Shelley.
That's a wrap of this edition of the Shelley Irwin Show, 9:55 in the morning. Did you know there's a Shelley Irwin Fun Run? Okay, it's not till April, but we need to talk about it now. April 25th, 10 a.m., Millennium Park, raising funds for WGVU Public Media. Pretty critical at this point. We'll be talking about it and or asking you to be involved. The Shelley Irwin Fun Run. Yes, health and wellness, the key. Bring your dog. We're going to put special emphasis on that. Bring your dog. And I should bring all three of mine, but that probably won't happen. So, 9:56 in the morning, your inspiration for the day. According to Zora Neale Hurston, there are years that ask questions and years that answer. Hope you enjoyed the show. Have a great day.